Hey everyone, it's December, it's gift season, and I'm guessing that, like me, you might be struggling to figure out, what should I give for him and what about for her? Well, one thing you know is basically no one returns alcohol. So this year, get those people on your list the gift of beer, wine, and spirits delivered with Drizly in under 60 minutes. Drizly gets that delivery done in under 60 minutes. Right now, Drizly is giving every new customer $5 off their first order. Just use the promo code FAST5 at checkout. That's F-A-S-T number 5. So download the Drizly app or go to drizly.com. That's D-R-I-Z-L-Y.com and use the promo code FAST5 for $5 off your order. That's Drizly, the number one app for alcohol delivery.
Actually, me and Miguel were the only prospects to be able to get invited to Big League Camp. And it got down to the last week of Big League Camp, and me and Miggy are looking at each other like, man, I'm number 77, but I might make this damn team. You know what I mean?
Hey there, Baseball America podcast listeners. Kyle Bandujo here, host of our interview series here at Baseball America, From Phenom to the Farm. If you've never listened, the podcast is over on its own feed, and every other Tuesday, we talk to a former professional baseball player about their journey from amateur ball all the way on up through the professional ranks. Reason we're here on this feed today is because our most recent episode, we're talking to a guy who needs no introduction, who all baseball fans are a fan of, a former big league all-star, Dontrell Willis. Comes as no surprise to anyone who was a fan of his during his playing career or his current career as an analyst. Dontrell makes for a great conversation. Wanted to bring it here to the BA feed. Not many players in baseball history have hit superstardom as fast as Dontrell. He went from double-A prospect to essentially a household name in baseball circles in about a two-month span back on that 2003 Marlins team that would end up winning the World Series. We talk about learning to deal with that fame, getting back his love for baseball a bit later in his career after baseball had knocked him down a little bit, and then, of course, had to break down his iconic windup and his batting stance. Dontrell had just that big old leg kick. Huge fan. So this is a great conversation. Hope everyone enjoys it. If you haven't checked out From Phenom to the Farm before, we're nearly 50 episodes deep. We've had World Series winners. We've had, you know, guys who spent nearly a decade in indie ball. First round picks, 42nd round picks, guys who played in the College World Series, and guys who never made it to campus. If you enjoy this, you know, this conversation with Dontrell, go check out our backlog. It's, you know, it's all a pretty evergreen. Episodes come out every 2 weeks. Subscribe so you can get the next one. Without further ado, let's talk to Dontrell Willis. Joining in for today's episode From Phenom to the Farm, he was an eighth round pick of the Cubs in the 2000 draft, former big league all-star Dontrell Willis. Dontrell, thanks so much for joining us From Phenom to the Farm.
Not a problem. Thank you for having me. It's going to be a blast.
I'm looking forward to it, man. I've been following you on Instagram, and I know you're staring at a tee time right now. What is the best course you played lately?
You know, I've been very blessed to play. You know, I live in Arizona full time, so I played Whistler Rock, Scottsdale National. I'm a member at DC Ranch, which is a beautiful course. It's all first world problems up here, you know what I mean? But, you know, I just enjoy going out there and then trying to get a couple birdies and getting the hell out of there.
Yeah, y'all have quite the little MLB alumni group out there. We had Barry Enright on the podcast a while back, and I know he can swing the sticks.
That's my dog. He's one of my best friends, and he's I like to tell people he's obnoxiously good. Like, it's really disrespectful how good he is, and I joke with him all the time. I say, man, you're a better golfer than you ever was a pitcher. So he's that good, but he's fun to watch and a hell of a guy.
You search him on Google now, it says pro golfer. Doesn't say former big league baseball player.
Absolutely.
Let's roll into your career going back to your amateur high school days. When did you first realize you had a future at the next level, and why baseball for you? I've seen you pitch, I've seen you hit. You're an athlete.
You know, to be honest, it's actually a funny story, but the one time I had detention, Mr. Horwitz, in my whole life for missing a class. And it was right around probably like 2 weeks before the draft. And our whole school was making a big buzz about it. You know what I mean? And to, you know, a 17-year-old, it's just whirlwind to you. You know what I mean? You just want to get a box pizza and some cookies. You know, that's your life day to day. You know what I mean? And I didn't realize I could be a professional or be good at it until Mr. Horwitz said, you know, He's like, I'm not a big fan of sports, but everybody is making a big deal about you either going to college or getting drafted and going professionally. He's like, man, you could always go to college, man. I think you should go for your dreams. And this is coming from a man that really doesn't like sports. And as I'm writing out, I hate the tension on my paper right now. Like, it kind of dawned on me at that moment, like, hey, you know, maybe I could, you know, have a career playing professional baseball. So it was just a weird thing that hit at that moment. And I said, hey, I'm going to give it a go.
So got to talk about the delivery, the fame delivery. The lore is that you learned it from your mom. When we saw, we as a baseball fan of public, what we saw that debuted in the big leagues when you were 21, right, is that what it always looked like? Or are there certain iterations, certain changes you made?
You know what? I'm built like a rake in the sense of my butt's on my shoulder. Like, I can get my wallet over my back pocket, over my shoulder right here, you know. But it's just, you know, I've always been a gangly guy, you know what I mean? And I always, you know, Dennis Eckersley was a hero of mine, you know, and I grew up in the heydays of the A's and the Giants being good, you know, Battle of the Bay, you know. I'm a young boy. So I've been blessed to witness great baseball and Hall of Fame type baseball. But I've always had the leg kick. I've always had deception, you know, I've always had life with it. But I think as I got in the pros, being hyped up, I think the leg kick got a little higher and higher to the point where
a confidence, you know, leg kick.
Yeah, exactly. But it was something that I've always thrown it, and it's always been quirky, and it always gave hitters fits.
So when you signed with the Cubs, though, how many times, if ever, did you get approached by someone in the organization, someone a pitching coach, or someone in the Marlins organization when you got dealt,
right,
and be like, hey, nice delivery, but let's change that? Did you have to, was there any like pushback of staying in within yourself on that?
To be honest, it was so messed up, they didn't even know where to begin. To be honest with you, they would just look and they're just, and on top of my funky delivery, like, you can ask anybody that's ever played with me, like, my ball moves everywhere. So it's like, I don't even know where to begin with this kid, but he's athletic. He loves to compete, and, you know, he competes in the strike zone. So it was one of those things where it was a really, really gigantic Rubik's Cube of mess. But they also like my athleticism and my competitiveness. So I could count probably 100 pitching coaches and farm directors alike. We don't know what the hell's going on with this leg kick, but he's consistent. And if you break down my windup slowly, I've done a good job of just getting into power positions to where you look at it, it's like, okay, that seems normal. Is this the leg kick that we're getting, you know, mesmerized by?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing that, like, even growing up with all these instructors and stuff, it's like, you can do whatever you got to do, but you just got to get to certain positions, pitching or hitting. And speaking of hitting and something mechanical, I texted a buddy of mine and I was like, hey, man, Dontrell Willis coming on the podcast. And he didn't say anything about pitching. He said, oh, old daddy hack. So in high school, were you bringing your leg up to your hip before you swung?
It swung out. Actually, my leg kick, and Jeff Conine, a hero of mine, absolutely awesome teammate, you know, between the swing velocity and the backswing, almost the recoil was just as fast, if not faster. But I always just loved being on the field, man. I was a kid where I was a field rat. Like, you always saw me at the park playing basketball or flag football or playing strikeout. You just always saw it. So, you know, I just always trusted my athleticism. And in my senior year, I hit 629. So that, you know, a couple scouts were like, maybe he can handle the bat. And I was like, nah, you don't want to see me in the outfield catching fly balls. That's another debacle. But, you know, I always loved handling the bat, and I always just loved just being part of the game. And I guess, like, you hear, like, some people are American League guys or some guys are National League guys. I think I've always been a National League guy in that sense.
Yeah. I mean, clearly, look at your batting line. So you get into pro ball, you get drafted by the Cubs. You're out in the AZL a little bit your first season, but you're year after getting drafted, you go out to short season, go out to Boise. What is different about that first season in pro ball and short season than any other season you have in your career? Like, how much do you have to learn? Like, how much catch up is there that's never really a problem in other seasons because you've already done it?
It's catch up every season. And that's the cool thing about baseball. You know, it's kind of like golf. You're always learning something. You're always learning nuances, whether it be mechanically, physically, mentally. You know, it's a grind for guys. And the talent level, like, it seems like every time you pass a level in Sonic the Hedgehog, it gets harder and harder, and the talent gets better and better. And you're seeing guys, like, I remember being in A-ball and seeing Carlos Zambrano and Mark Pryor in Double-A and thinking, like, I'm never going to make it to the big leagues. This is what Double-A baseball is, because they're just so talented. But, you know, you learn how to just get stronger and lift weights and eat a little better. Like, you know, as much as I love Jack in the Box, you know, you have to be, you know, a little more in tune to your nutrition. This generation, I think they understand the strength of that. That's the difference now. But, you know, it was fun just learning nuances, learning how to scout, learning how your pitches affect the hitters and stuff, because everyone said I threw the hardest 89 you've ever seen in your life. Like, it just had life and explosion. So it's just cool to learn the nuances of the game and doing whatever it takes to get to the big leagues.
So as you get into that professional lifestyle too, it was just announced this coming year is going to be the first year that MLB organizations are covering housing for their minor leaguers. Right. Back in the early 2000s, what was your situation in those first in Kane County and in Jupiter and Carolina?
Oh my God. A lot of care packages sent by families, jackets, like cup of noodles. I remember so vividly, like, anybody that got a care package and it'd be this huge box, and it, like, you know, guys would have top ramen and gummy bears and like throwing them around. You know, it's a true grind down there in the minor leagues. And thank God for the host family situations. You know what I mean? I'm still friends and tight with the host families I had in Kane County and in Boise, Idaho as well. Like, just opening their arms and their doors and just being a fan of baseball and taking in these kids that you basically don't know, and you get to learn about the nuances of the things they're going through. So, you know, God bless those families that are doing that, but it is a total grind. Every time I buy a cup of noodles for my kids, I get a little smile, like, you know, because I've been through it. I know how the hot water works. I know the levels and everything, but it's what I think it teaches you, hard work and perseverance, because in the major leagues, the season and the grind is so long. So there's no institute in the world like the minor leagues.
Listen, cup of noodles and ramen gets a bad rap, but that's still a good
meal. It gets a very bad rap. You get that spicy chicken with some crackers, baby, it tastes like steak. I mean, most of the time, but we'll see. Yeah,
tastes
absolutely
wonderful. So you have some success your first 2 years in the Cubs system, to say the least, so much so that you're regarded well enough to be one of the main prospect pieces in a trade. Matt Clement and Tony Alfonseca going to Chicago. You head over to the Marlins organization. We've had guys who usually deals involving prospects are in the offseason or trade deadline, something like that, getting traded towards the end of spring training. You know, what's it like when you think you're breaking camp and you know, with a certain organization, then suddenly you're having to revamp everything you do and you've got all these, you know, these new people around you?
Craziest thing during that trade, into spring training, guys are getting released. So just the energy around the locker room is getting a little tense because, you know, I mean, you don't want to, you know, you have your little mini Joe Boo out there hoping you don't get a name sticker in your locker. I mean, it's really like that. So the day of the trade, three of my roommates get released and I get traded, you know, so it's just a shell shock of a situation. And when you're a little kid, I mean, you're a kid, you're a child, you know, I mean, you're a young man, but you're a child. It's just really hard to just receive. And the next day I'm at Cocoa Beach in Florida, never been to Florida, never been on that side of the country ever. And this is like, man, like my new teammates, it's almost kind of like you go to a new school your senior year of high school, you know what I mean? Trying to make friends, trying to fit in, and this, you know, proving to everybody this new organization that you belong. So, but it was whirlwind, but it was actually a blessing in disguise.
So that 03 season, you start out in AA Carolina, you and Miggy down in AA Carolina. You're there early on, you're pretty lights out. You essentially haven't had an ERA over 2 in almost a year at that point. When you're in AA, did you have the chance to think like, why am I not in the big leagues right now? Or were you still like working on stuff like, there's something I got to do before I get there? Is it just like, when am I getting that call?
Nah, it was just competing and staying there. it wasn't anything about, you know, when am I going to get in the big leagues? But the funny thing about that was, you know, the spring training before that, I got invited to big league camp. Actually, me and Miguel were the only prospects to be able to get invited to big league camp. And it got down to the last week of big league camp, and me and Miggy are looking at each other like, man, I'm number 77, but I might make this damn team. You know what I mean? So I remember I struck out Barry Larkin, and he comes walking down, and I think he's going to just berate me, and he's like, you're gonna make it to the big leagues, man, you just continue to work. So fast forward into the AA season, we had a really, really good team in Zebulon, North Carolina. Obviously, Miguel Cabrera is in the beginning of his Hall of Fame path, hitting almost like 500. And so I'm just riding his coattail at that. I was smart enough to know that if I'm going to stick with this guy right here, he's going to take me to bigger and better things. But we were a competitive group with each other. We were a competitive group playing other teams. And just the talent level was really outstanding. But I felt like, you know, if I continue on this path, I'll have a good chance of making it to the big leagues.
Well, walk me through getting that call then.
Oh, man. Off day in Orlando, whole team is gathered about $300. So we got Natty Ice beer. Great beer. But
I will ride hard for Natty Ice. I mean, Natty Ice right now might kill me, but at 21, yeah. Natty Ice is a fine beverage.
Absolutely. My liver was young enough for that. And, you know, like I said, we were a very, very close-knit team. Randy Messenger was my roommate at the time. And he's like, man, your phone keeps ringing. And I don't know if I was in Miguel's room or somebody else's room in Kissimmee, but he's like, man, your phone keeps ringing. So finally, Brad Penny, who had my number during big league camp, calls me. It's like, hey, man, you know, they're looking for you right now. And I'm like, you know, my heart's just racing because you don't know what the hell's going on. You know what I mean? And so they tell me they're going to call me up. And I literally, just my heart just dropped because, you know, at that moment, you realize that, you know, you're living every childhood kid's dream, and now you get to play amongst the best in the world. So, you know, I didn't have any money on me. I probably had $40. So I had to ask my friends for some money because I literally was starving. And next thing you know, I'm literally on a crop duster going all the way from Orlando to Miami. And I remember the plane shook so much. I was like, please, just give me to South Florida. I just want to throw one pitch in the big leagues. But I will say this. The coolest thing about being called up is all of my teammates were sincerely happy for me, including Miguel. And I remember Miguel telling me, like, and I tell everybody this, he says, I'm coming. I'm going to be next, Negro. I'm coming. And I said, oh, trust me, man. I think they got the wrong person on this call up, brother. But yeah, I know you're coming. But everybody was sincerely happy for me. And that was the coolest part about it.
Yeah, he joined you pretty soon after. So settling into the big league team, that's a team that is lot of vets, a lot of guys who have a lot of service time. Right. You're 21, you're a young black guy from California. Your manager is a 72-year-old guy from New Jersey who got there like right before you did. How did you mesh with Jack McKeon?
Trainer Jack is, I mean, he's forgotten more baseball than most of us can remember ever. I mean, he's managed everyone. I think I saw something where he's managed 3% of anybody that's played baseball ever or something, like something crazy, but he was a man that understood hard work and appreciated that. And I was always a kid that loved to work hard. You know, that's where my confidence came. So we hit it off tremendously. He was like the grandfather that really just told me how to do things right. You know, don't do this, do this, work hard, be a great teammate. So we meshed very, very well. I remember one time, though, he came to give me off the mound and I missed his hand giving him the ball. And he came in there and he grabbed me, and that 75-year-old man turned into a 24-year-old man. And I said, and he saw tears in my eyes because I was like, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to do that. I was just so frustrated about the outing. You know what I mean? My mind was elsewhere. And he grabbed my arm and I was like, man, I felt like my grandfather grabbing me. So he was definitely in tune with the current ways of the game and stuff like that. And he could relate to everybody.
So you're called up May 9th. By June 30th, you're in Sports Illustrated. You go from April, really only like prospect heads, people who read Baseball America knew who you were, to by the All-Star break, you're one of the most famous players in baseball. I'm 12 at that time, and it's like Barry and you. On the field, obviously, you handled things well. Like, you know, great, great year. What was the experience like off the field? When was the first time you realized you were a legit famous person? Because a lot of baseball players can walk through life, even like Mike Trout can walk down the street and pretty normally, but
yeah, I, you know, you don't really, it was outer body, especially in Miami. And then the turn of the ball club, that's what I cared about more so than anything. If you could ask any of my teammates that, I didn't like any of that D-Train stuff. I didn't like the conductor hats. I didn't like any of it because I felt like it singled me out. Like you could ask anybody that played with me. I hated when people called me D-Train at that time. Like I don't take compliments well. You know, I mean, I've always been that guy, and I thank God for Juan Pierre and Derek Lee. Those guys put their arm around me and really just taught me the ropes of just working hard, showing up, being a good teammate. But it's whirlwind because, I feel a lot of honor saying that once I got called up and Miguel got called up, the Marlins got pushed to the national scale as far as like, hey, this team's for real. And then you just saw the fans come from, 8,000 to 20,000 to 30,000. It was traffic into the field. It's like, what the hell is going on? Like, we're just not used to this. Like, you know what I mean? So that was cool to be a part of that. But to see the conductor hats and the D chain and people doing a leg kick, it just made me laugh, man, because it's like, I can't believe this is happening to me right now.
What's the learning curve like picking the brain of, you got Pudge as your catcher, you got a rotation right. That's, it's a young rotation, but it's like Pavano, Redmond, Josh Beckett. Like, what's that first year learning curve like when you're figuring out big league hitters, how to go about your business?
Well, the first thing is, and it was easy for me to be myself because I don't throw 100. And at the time, Josh Beckett threw 100, AJ Burnett threw 100, Brad Finney threw 100, these corn fed guys that this ripped it at guys and threw breaking balls at 90 miles an hour. A lot of the stuff you see today. But the one thing they loved kind of sandwiching me in between is a different look. You know what I mean? A lefty, a guy that's deceptive, you know what I mean? Doesn't mind throwing inside. But the one thing I learned from all those guys is you have to establish the inner half, because at that time, Bonds was hitting bombs. Like, the ball was flying out of the ballpark. Kind of the end of that era, if you will, you know what I mean, where everybody's hitting 20, 30 home runs. But, it was something that I learned. Throw strikes, work efficiently, keep your defense on the toes, which, I mean, we have one of the best defenses in all of baseball. So, especially how hot it is, you don't want your fielder standing out there all damn day. So, so throw strikes, attack the zone, and really just be competitive.
Did Dusty Baker do you dirty in the 03 All-Star game?
And that's a great question. And every time I see him, I bring it up, and he cussed me out every time I bring it up. But no. Listen, Billy Wagner was warming up next to me, and I thought about it for a second, and it's like, if you would put in Dontrell Willis or Billy Wagner train, who would you put in? I chose Billy Wagner my damn self. So I put in a glorified bullpen and just sled it a little bit, and Billy went out there and got him. But he didn't do me dirty. I enjoyed it, just being around those guys.
What was something your second round, the second time going to the All-Star game in 05, that you made sure to do that you might not have done in 03?
Just get in the game. And it's so funny because he never lets it down. But Mark Teixeira hits a home run off me. And, it's an All-Star game. I'm being aggressive. Here it is. We're just having fun. But the one cool thing was I got to play on the field beside Jimmy Rollins, a guy I grew up with in Alameda, California. So that was cool for our families to see each other. And I got him a double play ball. But, Mark Teixeira hits a home run off me. And then after the game, I see my mother hugged up with them, and it's like, if you can't add insult to injury, and Mark never lets it go. Every time I see Mark Teixeira, he always gives me shit about it. But a Hall of Fame, obviously, type player, he's on the ballot this year. But just to get in the game and experience that and see the joy of all the families, and it's a true honor to say that you can say you were once one of the best in the world.
So that run up to the 03 World Series, you get some starts in the postseason, goes to the World Series itself against the Yankees, right. And you find out, how did you respond internally when you were, found out you're not going to start, you're in the bullpen?
Oh, I was fine because I was terrible. Like, that's one thing that, anybody that's played with me, even my golf swing, like, I'm brutally honest about my play and myself. I don't mind it, and if you want to be good at something, you kind of have to be your hardest critic and be honest with yourself. So I remember we were finally flying to New York, and Jack never walks on the plane. He's walking on the plane. So everyone's like, what the hell is Jack doing? And so he comes right up to me and he tells me on the plane, we want you to switch Posada to the right side and you have Giambi. And I'm like, he's like, Train, if you don't get it together, we don't win this World Series. And it's kind of a flight or fight situation where it's like, do you feel sorry or do you welcome that challenge? And I felt like I welcomed that challenge. Didn't also feel like I was really going to factor in the game. And sure enough, I'm in game one. Right out of the bullpen in a tough situation. But I appreciate Jack and the staff continuing to believe in me to give me that situation to play better and give us a chance to win.
So when he tells you that, like, you're like, okay, you know right away, like, okay, I'm gonna get a right-handed Posada, and then I've got Giambi. Do you start then suddenly, like, are you game planning those at bats in your head until you actually get to the game, or is it just situation, you know, depends on the situation?
I mean, as a 21-year-old, you're going to Yankee Stadium and you're playing in the World Series. It's like, man, I just hope I don't lose my luggage, man. Like, you can't fathom, like, you're looking at the Yankees and the Monument Park and this everything, all the videos they're playing, and Yogi Berra and all these guys are there, and it's just a surreal moment. But once the game started, yeah, I started to focus on the situation. And even if you're not in the game, during the postseason, you're grinding every pitch, every bat. I mean, I'm grinding as an analyst now watching the postseason, so if you're involved in it. And I'll never forget when the phone rang in the bullpen, everybody's heart stops. It gets silent. It's a weird thing, man. Everyone gets silent. And all of a sudden they say, Willis. And my first response was like, what? I literally said, what? And they're like, you got to hurry. I spit all my sunflower seeds out of my mouth. And I literally put my hat on, my cleats untied. I go out there. I warm up in the bullpen, and I don't throw one pitch close. Not one pitch close. It's like I'm bouncing fastballs. And all of a sudden, Jack comes out of the bullpen and points down. And I'm like, oh, my goodness. Like, this is happening. You know what I mean? This is happening. I finally get to play in the World Series game. And running out of that bullpen, which seemed like a mile and a half from left field, the only thing I could think of was, please don't trip and fall. There's 80 million people watching. Not the hitters, not the situation. I'm just thinking as a 21-year-old kid, don't trip and fall. Get to the mound. And Jack, he's like, looks around. He's like, well, go get him, Trey. And I was like, that's the most you can say? Like, I need to remember the Titans speech right now. You know what I mean? Like, I need some motivation. But, you know, I went in there and got the job done. So it was really, really fun to just be a part of something like that and playing amongst the best in the world.
So how did your offseason change that year from your previous offseasons? Now you're a big leaguer, you're D-Train, you're a World Series champion. Right. What was different about that winter?
Well, I, you know, when I came back home, I was still sleeping on my mom's couch as a World Series winner. So that had to change. You know what I mean? I finally got an apartment with my best friend, Mazzani Franklin. And it was just surreal, man. Like, everywhere we went, being from the Bay Area, we went to Dave and Buster's. Everyone just went nuts. And it was just surreal. Like, even my friends that I know all my life, I could tell they kind of looked at me different. Like, this fool is really a professional athlete that just won the World Series. And the coolest thing that happened that night was, like, we're at Dave and Buster's, and, you know, and I'm chilling with all my friends, and it had to be like 20 of us. And, you know, all of a sudden they have that Sports Illustrated commercial where you can buy the book and, you know, the Marlins World Series champion, and they show highlights of me, and they just go ape. And it's just, you know, like I said, you know, it's outer body, but, you know, the whole time I'm just thanking the Lord just to be a part of it, and I can take care of my family and stuff. But I definitely had to get my ass off that couch at mom's house. That's what happened.
Gotta get your own
place.
Yeah,
absolutely.
So 2 years later, 05, you win 22 games. You're second in Cy Young voting. 7 complete games, 5 shutouts. That wasn't that long ago. We might not ever see just those numbers ever again. You're at the peak of your powers at that point. In retrospect, do you wish you'd been handled kind of like guys are handled now, you know, being worked a little less hard? Like, how do you look back on those numbers? Because you, from the moment you got in the minors, you were an innings eater. You led the Northwest League in innings your first year.
No, I believe in the Lord, and he has a path for all of us, you know, whether it be, you know, good, bad, or indifferent. I wouldn't change a thing. Now, it's a little tough to fade the ball when you can't bend your elbow straight. You know what I mean? But no, I always knew that that's how I was going to be successful, by being out there and pitching a lot of innings and being that type of weapon to help our bullpen, especially in Miami, where, you know, we had a lot of short starts, our bullpen were taxed. Like, they really leaned on me to be like, Trey can handle the workload. Even if he falls behind, he can go 8 innings and he can go 7 innings and really shorten the ball game for us. So no, I don't wish anything different in my career, good or bad. You know what I mean? That's how I made my money. And I think at that time, the era in the minor leagues, they were teaching guys to be able to go deep in ball games. Like, it wasn't any of this, you know, 4 innings, 5 innings, you know, pitch count things. It was the pitch count of getting yourself up to 100 pitches, and that's your ball game. So it was still kind of that old school mentality of, like, you go as deep as you can, and then we'll make up for the rest. But now it's a different ball game.
Also, in 2005, you're the first black pitcher to win 20 games since Dave Stewart. In that era, you've got you. There's Barry Bonds, Jimmy Rollins, CeCe. There's been, even since you've broken in, there's been a decline in the number of black players right. in Major League Baseball. It's down almost 4% since you broke into baseball, you know, down more than that since like 91. Where do you see where MLB, the sport itself, the sport of baseball itself, is failing or can make up some ground in keeping that talent in baseball as opposed to other sports?
Well, you know, I think that responsibility, you know, kind of falls on the legacy of the players. And what I mean by is, you know, the CeCe Sabathias, the Curtis Brandersons, the Edwin Jacksons. There's a lot of people that are putting their boots on the ground to be in communities of black and brown people, you know, just explaining the joy of the game. You know, I'm part of a group called the Players Alliance, and it's headed by those guys. And they've done a phenomenal job of just going around the country, giving gloves, giving bats. Baseball is very expensive. You know what I mean? That TPX bat back in 99 was $280. My mom was like, you got one thing under the Christmas tree, and that's that TPX bat. You know what I mean? Like, so, you know, you have to take that into consideration, especially nowadays. You know, times are harder for people. So, you know, I mean, to buy that $200 glove, to get that bat, that's tough. So there's a lot of people that are in the community that really deserve their flowers. But Major League Baseball, I think they're trying hard to be in the uptick, be more presentable of this, you know, the Mookie Betts of the game, and say, hey, you have representation and you can play this game at a high level. But like you said, it's the same thing with Mike Trout, though, being a white player. I mean, there's some areas in Los Angeles he could walk by and no one bothers him. You know, that's a problem. So I think just the promotion of the game itself, they can do a little bit better. Now, I can't do anything about that, but you know, I try to go out there and shed light on the game and tell everybody, especially, you know, people of my color, that it's a great game to play.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think one of the big things with that, too, is because college baseball, the scholarship situation, like, why play baseball and still graduate in student loan debt when right. you can go play a different sport where there's full rides? So for you, after that, how does life change just as an athlete, as a professional athlete, after you hit arbitration as a baseball player? What is that, once you get to that point, you've gotten there and you've stayed, how does that change your life moving forward?
Honestly, it really didn't. This more people ask me for stuff. You know what I mean? Like, it really, you know, and listen, my friends can tell you, my childhood friends and guys I play with professionally, I've always been the same. I take a lot of pride of treating people how I want to be treated. Like, I never really tried to get too gassed up in that. I bought some ridiculous ass chains that I don't need now, and I never wear because I don't go anywhere. You just learn. You learn about things like that. You know, one of my best friends, Justin Upton, I remember he bought this ridiculous house, and now he's like, man, I don't need all that. I got, you know, touch screens in the walls. They're dirty because I'm touching them with dip and barbecue. It's just, you just learn. You grow up and you mature. You know, you make mistakes and you learn from those things. But no, it really didn't change. I mean, as far as the responsibility of being a captain and a leader, that's one thing I cared about more so than that. This really gravitating to the locker room and really getting these guys to try to play the best baseball. I was more concerned about, will these guys follow me now that I'm thrusting into leadership form. But as far as off the field, this, you know, more money, more problems. But, you know, it was all a blessing. It was really all a blessing. I wouldn't change it for the world.
So there's 30 big league cities. I'm sure they all have their pros and cons. Mm-hmm. How did you take the news moving from Miami to Detroit?
I it was crazy because this is a true story. I'm in Mexico and Cabo, and I see my face, but I can't understand what the hell they're saying. This is a true story. This is a true story. I was with Josh Hamilton, a bunch of big leaguers, and my agent at the time took us on a trip to Cabo, a bunch of players. And so I'm looking, and my agent's on the phone, and this is, I swear I can't make this up. Like, I'm looking at the sports thing, and I see my face, and I'm thinking I'm drunk because I'm like, why am I seeing my face on this, you know, this Spanish news channel? Like, and next thing I know, me and Miguel are being traded, and it was just surreal. It was surreal. But I did tell those guys in Detroit, I'm not getting off this beach until 4 or 5 days from now. So I'll be in Detroit and I'll be in that snow. But it was surreal. And they had a good team. Justin Verlander is a Hall of Famer, you know, great teammates, you know what I mean? Guys like that. So we were just excited. And again, it just brought back that feeling of when I got traded from the Cubs to the Marlins, like, oh man, this is really going to happen. And this is the part of the business that, you know, you can't control. But if I had a choice, I would love to stay with the team that gave me a chance. you know, and but it's a weird thing. I think that was kind of the era where now you see guys, great players change teams and it's okay. You see Max Scherzer on his fourth team, I believe, now signing with the Mets. And, you know, he's a Hall of Famer, but, you know, I kind of wanted to be that Tony Gwynn type where I just stayed at that one place for a very long time.
Especially when that place has a nice beach.
You know, that helps. That helps. And I love Detroit to the death, and I love the snow, but that snow gets a little tough to throw in sometimes.
Yeah, well, speaking of, so Detroit, obviously things on the field don't look like Miami. When did physically things start to not feel right, and how is it mentally kind of just trying to grind through that?
I think it was more of a mental thing because, like, I get traded over here. I want to be a factor, and it just – everything I did went to shit. Excuse my language, but everything I did. And the way I know how to work is, like, maybe I'm not working hard enough. I got to work harder. I got to work harder. And really, it was a lesson of working smarter. Now that I play golf, that's the lesson that you learn. You have to be smooth. It's not just, you know, hammering away, because it was almost like I felt like I was in quicksand. You know, the harder I fought, the worse it got. And listen, the team's being competitive, and they're trying to get into the postseason. So when you turn into a liability, I don't care what sport you're in, you know, what industry you're in, now it's a problem. So, you know, it just, you know, and then I developed the yips, and then it really just started to really just, you know, stockpile. So I think it was more of just a mental thing of just learning how to downshift and back off and just let the game come to you.
Following that time in Detroit, again, like you said, to go through the yips, go through those injuries, just results on the field that are not what you were in Miami. You latch on with Arizona, Cincinnati, you know, split time between AAA and the big leagues. When you're on the mound with the Reds, you're in about 70 innings with the Reds. Do you have the same confidence the 2005 guy had, even if not the same stuff, or are you just kind of like missing the peak of your powers?
No, huge. I have a great deal of love and appreciation for the Cincinnati Reds. He really put his arm around me. Dusty Baker was there. And they said, you know, we're going to give you a chance. But the line that they told me, which was really rejuvenating, was it's like, man, we just want you to be yourself, man. Like, I think as an athlete, you know, even when you're a fan of the guy, you could see somebody really grinding and really wanting it. You know what I mean? And so, you know, got a chance, got an invite to big league camp, didn't pitch well at the end. So they told me, hey, we want you to be a starter in AAA, because I was trying to win a job relieving, never relieved before. Hate being in the bullpen. It's a different monster. Everybody in that bullpen's insane, by the way. That bitch is down there. You know, and I took it as an opportunity to really work hard and refine my mechanics and really just learn how to love the game again. Because at that time, I didn't love baseball at all. I was just doing it because it was just, you know, something I had to do or something. I don't know the reason why, but I really appreciate the Reds giving me opportunity because they really put the love back into my game. So when I got called up, I was more proud of myself being able to overcome the yips, being able to compete well. Help guys like Aroldis Chapman, who's going to be a Hall of Famer, you know what I mean? Cueto, Volquez, you know, they're all under my wing learning from me, but also pushing me to work hard and be the elder statesman. So I love my year in Cincinnati. I really appreciate it. They just didn't hit for me in the big leagues, you know what I mean? So I give Brandon Phillips and Joey Votto crap every time I hear from them. But no, the Reds are a first-class organization, and I really appreciate them.
If you come all the way back, why go pitch for the Long Island Ducks? Like, at that point, you've banked what you've banked. What do you have to prove by going to play indie ball?
That's a great question. I don't know. Like, I just – that's a great question. Obviously the love of the game, the love and appreciation of the game. And you gotta love it when you're in Camden, New Jersey, you know, pitching. You got, and no disrespect to Camden, New Jersey, the city, but it's just, you know, it's a level where everybody wants to get out of there. You know what I mean? They want to use it as a jump start, but the fans loved it. Like, the fans love having me there. I saw Willis jerseys at the mall in Long Island. And you gotta understand, Long Island's really a long way where the stadium is. It's a long way from Yankee Stadium. So these people, like, you know, they really come out. So we would average anywhere from 9 to 10,000 people. So just seeing the joy in us playing well and battling and scrapping and, you know, me buying spreads every other night and stuff like that. It was the minor leagues again, but it was the joy of baseball. But, hey, you know, that's a great question. I don't know what the hell I was thinking.
What made the final decision as far as, okay, time to hang it up, time to take up golf?
I was in big league camp with the Brewers. I worked my tail off to even get signed with the Brewers. And I run in my polls. I was hurt the whole time, but something was going on with my shoulder or my neck, and I'm trying to battle. And I run my polls, and I see Knable and was it Williams throwing? And these guys are low A ball guys at the time. You know what I mean? So, crazy thing. I drove back up to 17 feeling fulfilled. And I just said, you know, I told my family, I think this is enough. I think I put enough time in the game. I think I left my mark in the game, you know, and I'm proud of myself. I don't owe anybody else anything. You know what I mean? Like, so, but once I saw Williams and Knable throwing, it was like, train, you don't have a chance. you don't have a chance. And that's okay. You know, that's okay. You know, like in Moneyball, like whether you're 18 or 40, you know, the Billy Bean line, somebody's going to tell you that you can't play this game anymore. So it was emotional that next day, you know. But it was a hell of a ride. And I appreciate all the friendships I made, all the ups and downs, you know, being able to be a World Series champion. You know, you look back at that and say, you did all right, you know, from being from a kid from Alameda, you did all right.
So if you could give a pep talk to your 18-year-old self right after signing, what would you tell that kid?
Enjoy it all. Enjoy it. Like, that's the only regret I look back on is I didn't enjoy it as much as I should, even though I'm kind of known for being a smiley guy and always, I didn't enjoy it as much as I should have because it went like that, you know, and that's the one thing. I'm a special assistant for the Dodgers. And I tell guys, man, enjoy all of this, man. Like, you know what I mean? This is such a cool life, man. And the game goes in and out just like that. And so enjoy competing, enjoy being around your teammates, man. Enjoy seeing your name on the back of a jersey, man, because it's not just about you. It's about your family and the legacy that you can leave. So, you know, I'm very proud that my daughters run around and my soccer daughter, she's called B-Train, you know, by everybody and stuff like that. So it's just cool, man. It's just cool that I left a mark, but just enjoy every single moment, man, because you never know when God's going to call us home.
I got a quick rapid fire for you, and then we'll let you get to that tea time.
All right.
Favorite big league ballpark?
Oh, all of them, because it's the show. All of them. The nachos are better in the show. Trust me, all of them.
Did you play in any minor league ballparks that were better than Pro Player Stadium?
Hey, put some respect on Pro Player, all right? Put some respect on that, all right? That was our home. Man, Shark, whatever the hell, Joe Robbie, I don't care what you want to call it. That was our home, baby. Nah, put some respect on it. No chance. No chance at all.
Best hitter you ever faced?
I want to say Barry, Albert, and it, those two guys, man. Barry and Albert are neck and neck, though. They're neck and neck. That's tough. You can't maybe do that. You can't maybe choose that.
Best pitcher you ever face?
Oh, man. Oh, I want to say Roger, but Pedro was nasty. Oh, man.
And he had that changeup going away from him. He's a lefty,
Pedro
too.
Pedro was nasty, man. Roy Oswalt, that's a great question because in my heyday when I was an ace, I faced everyone's number one. So I saw everybody's firsthand stuff. That's a tough one. But Pedro was pretty damn good.
Favorite dinger? Favorite big league dinger?
That I gave up or that I hit?
That you hit.
Whoo! I went second. Oh, no. I went second deck in Houston. That was pretty cool. But hit a grand slam in Shea and this
off Lima time.
Oh, God rest his soul. I love Lima. God rest his soul. He was a wonderful man. But yeah, I pretty much put a nail in Lima right there hitting that grand slam. But hearing the boos in New York is a different type of boo in New York than anywhere in the country.
Last question, ask everybody this. Do you have a nightmare bus ride story from the minor leagues?
Oh my God. Listen, They're all challenging. Let me just say that they're all very challenging. In AAA, I always like taking the team bus, and we all had these air mattresses. I don't know where we were in West Virginia, but it rained, so everyone got food, but then walked over the air mattresses. So they're wet air mattresses, literally rolling around. And I'm in AAA, and I'm thinking to myself, you know, I made a good living. You know, I don't need to do this. Right now, from Louisville, Kentucky, all the way to Norfolk, Virginia. That's our route. So, yeah, that was a soggy ride, but nevertheless, we played well.
That's when you start looking at flights to go home.
Absolutely. Like, you know, I mean, Chick-fil-A does not sound so bad right now with the kids, but no, you got to keep pushing.
Dontrell Willis, that's all I've got for you. Thanks so much for joining from Phenom the Farm. Hit him straight.
No problem, man. Appreciate you having me. Take care, brother.
Awesome. Take it easy. And that is it for our episode with Dontrell Willis. Huge thanks to Dontrell for taking the time. If you enjoyed this one, remember, subscribe wherever you get your podcast, rate and leave a review. We'll see you in 2 weeks. Thanks for listening.